Hello, everyone. This is your Captain Wade speaking, and I'm joined today by my executive officer and co-host, Will.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for listening.
We deeply apologize for the lateness of this episode. Needless to say, it's been a busy time for both me and Will. Will, I assume you are getting ready to go back to school. It's about that time of year.
That's right.
All right. As for myself, I've also gone back to school after a 2-year hiatus at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, Missouri. And Greek in 7 weeks is not fun. Not fun at all. And then also making sure that everything else is together, also not too much fun, but we're going to have some fun today. And I think this episode is going to be a fan favorite for all you naval warfare junkies out there. I know we are, wouldn't I say? Wouldn't I say that's correct, Will? We're both a bit of naval warfare
Oh,
junkies.
definitely. Oh, yeah.
Okay, so anyway, we are returning to the topic of naval warfare, but we're going to an era that may have a little more bang, like I said. Primarily, this deals with the last decade of the 19th century and all of the 20th and what we have of the 21st century at this point. This time period marked several quantum shifts in naval warfare and would change the environment on the high seas forever. Now, it all began with the HMS Dreadnought. Now, she is neither of our ships of the week, which we'll get to in a little bit, but she deserves some recognition regardless. Now, HMS, of course, means she was British. Before this point, even steam-powered warships had kept a similar design philosophies as ships before the American Civil War, as Will mentioned in the last episode. Most of the guns were lined up on the sides of the ships, and some even still had battering rams. If you look at the pre-Dreadnought era for French ships, you know what I'm talking about here. Ugh, some of those were plain ugly. So, anyway, HMS Dreadnought marked a design philosophy that would be the mainstay of every substantial navy for the next half century. Armored gun turrets that swung in what were called firing arcs. An armored hull with protective armor belts to provide vital functions, and secondary armaments for smaller targets and later for air defense. While this did allow for combat flexibility in that ships could fire on targets in any direction, lines of battle commonly seen in the 18th and 19th century were still common among these dreadnoughts, aka battleships, as we know them today. And let me tell you, battleships are a lot of fun to talk about. This era of the Dreadnought would last all the way until the end of World War II. During that time, the battleship became the supreme mark of a navy's ability to strike targets from afar. Yet every nation prioritized certain aspects over others. Up until the Second World War, for instance, navies prioritized firepower and armor above all else. Speed was an afterthought at best. What was it again, Will, that they were held to, the speed amount?
There wasn't necessarily a held to speed, but standard type American battleships, which were built during World War I and immediately after, were typically about 21 knot ships. By comparison, the Queen Elizabeth class, which was a contemporary British class, could do 24 or 25 knots. So we were significantly slower than some of the other countries.
And you would think that 3 or 4 knots would not be that much, but when you're talking about a speed that, you're talking 20 to 30 miles an hour, somewhere around that, when you're talking about the vast distances of the oceans, even 1 or 2 knots could shave hours or days off of trips, which in combat scenarios is very important. And also, it meant that you could outrun U-boats if you were fast enough. U-boats were flying in World War I and possibly even more so in the Second World War because they were even faster. But anyway, Will's also going to mention something about this later on with his ship of the week. But towards the end of the Second World War, and during the Second World War, I should say, a new design philosophy on warfare took shape, not just with, what ships were armed with, but how fleets were arranged. Will, would you care to explain this a little bit?
Sure. One of the major developments of the 20th century that really affected everybody was the development of the airplane. And of course, that had an enormous impact on naval warfare as well. And so, as we'll talk about when I get to my ship of the week, the USS Enterprise, aircraft carriers were initially created during World War I, but really didn't mature until World War II. And that's when they really took over for the battleship as the primary striking force of a fleet. But battleships didn't go away immediately. And so we'll talk a little bit about how their relationship changed over the course of World War II.
All right. Thank you very much, Will. And I honestly think, I think we can just talk about this a little bit in general, but battleships as a whole, what would you say is the quintessential difference between an American type battleship and a British type battleship? I alluded to this a little earlier, but of course, speed was one of them. But let's delve in a little bit. What was the main differences?
Well, it depends a little bit on which generation of battleships you're talking about. Because if we're talking about World War I type ships, U.S. ships in general had a design philosophy, as we mentioned, of being slower but very heavily armored. British battleships that were equivalent to U.S. battleships were also well armored, but the British also built another class of capital ships. And when we say capital ships, that means really the largest and most important vessels in the fleet. And this other type of capital ship that the British built was called the battle cruiser. And that is a type of ship that has battleship-sized guns, but not battleship-scale armor. Instead, it prioritizes speed. Originally, battle cruisers were invented to hunt down and destroy larger cruisers. But inevitably, because they carry battleship-sized guns, they ended up being used as battleships, particularly during World War I. And that actually ended up having some pretty disastrous consequences. The US did not actually build any battle cruisers until World War II. We did build two ships of what are called the Alaska class. We classify them as large cruisers, not battle cruisers, but for all intents and purposes, they really pretty much were. But for a long time, unlike the British and other navies which built battle cruisers, the Japanese and the Germans also did, we did not really prioritize speed as much.
All right. Part of it. And also, the British also experimented with gun placement, also to a large degree. What Will knows this about me, but I absolutely despise the HMS Nelson and the HMS Rodney. Now, these were two battleships during the that used all guns forward technique in terms of their gun placement. Now, this means that all of the guns were arranged in a way that all of them were forward of superstructure. Now, in some ways, this sounds like a good idea that that you point all your guns in a direction that ships are usually mostly firing towards or traveling towards. But at the same time, it also means that you had a huge weak spot anywhere where the guns could not point, which would be about a roughly a 120 degree area behind the ship. So if the Rodney or the Nelson were ever snuck up on by another force, there was literally nothing they could do. So this was a design philosophy.
There's a couple of interesting nuances to that design. The reason why the Nelson and the Rodney were built with that gun arrangement, and the reason why future ships, including the French Dunkirk and Richelieu class ships, were built with a similar arrangement, is actually to try to maximize the amount of armor that they could carry on a certain displacement. And this goes back to something called the Washington Treaty, which I'm sure we'll mention. But the Nelson and the Rodney are actually two of my favorite British battleships, primarily because they were so.
Yeah, like I said, we could go on about this
Long time.
for quite some time. Will and I have quite differing opinions about the Nelson and the Rodney, but I can't argue that they
Yeah.
were extremely effective in terms of the hunt for the Bismarck. The Rodney, I believe at least one of them were involved in the destruction of the German battleship, but we'll get to that. We'll get to that at a later date. I'm sure the hunt for the Bismarck will come on. But also, on the mention of battle cruisers, obviously we had the Battle of Jutland, which was a horrific naval engagement where both sides lost ships at almost a prodigious rate, I would say. And many of them were so-called battle cruisers. And also, of course, during the Second World War, the loss of the HMS Hood, which was probably the last major battle cruiser lost, if I remember correctly, at least.
The Repulse was lost later that year, but that was due to an air attack, not a gunnery
Right.
duel.
And that's where the weaknesses of a battle cruiser really played into it, that she would be sunk essentially by one hit. Now, of course, she most likely took other hits, but essentially, it was one fatal blow, really, that sunk the Hood. And that pretty much proved that battle cruisers couldn't hang with other ships that carried the same gun size as they did. And Bismarck and Hood actually were equal in terms of gun and gun size, 15-inch guns total. So really, you really had to deal with the fact that they couldn't compete in terms of armor. And that's honestly.
Well, it's an interesting nuanced narrative because the Hood, in many ways, kind of straddled the ground between a battleship and a battlecruiser. Her armor belt was roughly equivalent to a Queen Elizabeth class battleship of the same era, but she did have certain weak spots. And so contemporary scholars have really looked at the engagement between the Bismarck and the Hood, and it really has come down to the fact that the Bismarck's lucky shot that took out the Hood by hitting the magazines was really kind of a one in a million hit. And the Hood's armor belt was capable of resisting the Bismarck's guns, but the Bismarck just got exactly the right angle to hit her. Some people think that if the Hood had gotten in a few good hits first, the battle might have gone another way. So it's a real interesting story. The Hood's armor was actually significantly reinforced after Jutland when three battle cruisers were lost for that reason. We'll never really know how that could have ended differently.
Yeah. And, the wreck of the Hood, I'm sure, is not in good shape. When you think about it, she was a 20, 25-year-old ship by the time the Second World War rolled around. And then come spending, on the bottom of the ocean for 80 years. I mean, I'm really looking forward to the BBC program that's going to be coming out soon where they update us on the Titanic. And from what
Yeah, I've heard it's greatly deteriorated.
The preview photos have shown, the Titanic is not looking good at all. So,
Yeah.
anyway, I think it's about time that we get into our ships of the week. Don't you agree? All
Yep.
right. So, keeping on the topic of battleships for now, at least for now, my ship of the week is none other than HMS Vanguard. Again, British battleship. And known to some scholars as the British Misfit Battleship. First, some specs on this very interesting ship. Laid down in October of 1941, she would not be completed and commissioned until May of 1946. Look at those closely. You might see a problem with those dates. She was 814 feet or 248 meters and had a beam of 108 feet. She also had a maximum draft of 36 feet. Again, draft is the distance from the bottom of the ship to the waterline. So it's how much distance the ship really needs in order to sail safely, plus a few in most case. She was powered by eight boilers, four steam turbines, and could reach a speed of 30 knots. She was quite fast by any standard, but not quite as fast as the American Iowa class battleships that would be introduced a little later in the war. And she weighed about 50,000 tons approximately. Now, she rarely ever was fully loaded as a battleship, but I'll get to that later. She was armed with four twin 15-inch or 381 millimeter naval rifles, eight twin 5.25-inch DP secondary rifles, and these secondary guns were actually the British version of the 5-inch dual purpose guns that the United States used to such great effect. Anyway, and she was also armed with an assortment of 40 millimeter Bofors for AA defense. Now, I say a for various number of barrels for each AA gun placement. But anyway, we'll get to aircraft later. She had armor that ranged anywhere from 2 inches on the conning tower to 14 inches at her armor belt. And that 2 inches on the conning tower is surprising for an American like me and Will, because the conning tower was actually a place that you could find quite a bit more armor on, say, the Iowa class battleships. What was it again, Will? I believe you quoted something to me
I
once.
don't exactly the figure, but I think it's something like at least 12 inches, possibly as much as 18. So our conning towers were really thick by
And when you think
comparison.
about that, that makes sense. The superstructure of a ship is the most visible part of it, you could argue. So you should armor it well. But anyway, I said earlier, Vanguard could be considered the ultimate British misfit. Cobbled together from spare parts from, I shouldn't say spare parts, but from parts lifted from various ships, only ship produced of her class, and inheriting her main armament from two battle cruisers turned aircraft carriers, and her bridge superstructures seem lifted straight off of the KGV or Warspite after her refit. When Vanguard was laid down in 1941, with no end in sight at that point, and the threat of larger German battleships still terrorizing the waters around the UK, it was still a very real threat of German battleships. Vanguard would take the lessons of all the earlier classes of World War II BBs and be applied to make a near-perfect battleship in terms of British design philosophy. However, as Will will talk about later, it was clear by late 1942 into 1943 that the battleship was being replaced by the aircraft carrier. The aerial damage done to Bismarck and its sister Tirpitz, plus the decisive war going on in the Pacific, which Will will elaborate on later, for the United States showed a quantum shift in naval war paradigms. Battleships were no longer the fleet leaders, and in fact, a lot of times they were escorts. Vanguard would be the last new construction battleship, not only by the Royal Navy, but by any navy the world over, except for the last commissioned French battleship, Jean Bart, which entered service later in 1946. Yeah, horrible French pronunciation, I know. Unfortunately, it's not my specialty. However, HMS Vanguard would not go quietly in the years following the peace after the Second World War. One of her greatest contributions was improving the effectiveness of radar-directed fire control. Her 15-inch armament, which was nearly identical to HMS Warspite's, which scored a 20-meter hit, was now directed by the most advanced radar systems of the World War II era. Now, for our fellow Americans out there, that was one military technology that we did not invent and actually picked up from the British. The British were ahead of the game in terms of radar. Anyway, while she never fired a shot in anger, it was believed that Vanguard could land a hit on her first salvo nearly every time at distances similar to Warspite's. However, accuracy couldn't save Vanguard from the progress of time, and unfortunately for battleship fans like us. In the late 1940s and into the 1950s, Britain and much of Western Europe, for that matter, struggling to rebuild their economies. Ultimately, Great Britain decided finally that their large surface fleet would be better and put to better use in the British economy. Ships like Warspite, the remaining KGV battleships, Rodney and Nelson, light and heavy cruisers, and destroyers were all victims of this purge of large surface warships. This would have been Belfast, a town-class light cruiser, as the only example of the British Royal Navy from World War II. Now, HMS Vanguard later on would go on to be decommissioned in 1956 after plans were put in place originally for a missile battleship, essentially a large missile arsenal ship, which is actually an idea that navies today play with, at least. They never really commit, but they do play with the idea. Crew numbers are always something that they play with. In fact, Vanguard rarely even carried enough armament to fill her own magazines. Skeleton crew, all that, but eventually this all led to a decommissioning in 1956, and in 1960, the first cutting torch was laid to her in the scrapyards, and thus ended the era of the battleship, at least until the 1980s when it got a resurrection. But anyway, that is my ship of the week. And Will, I believe you have something to say about the most famous ship possibly that ever existed.
Definitely one of them. So my ship of the week is the USS Enterprise CV-6, a aircraft carrier, which has kind of continued a proud name or a proud tradition of that name in the U.S. Navy, going all the way back to a schooner which served in the Tripolitan War and has continued on with subsequent aircraft carriers, the CVN-65 and then CVN-80, which is an upcoming ship. But anyway, the USS Enterprise is the most decorated U.S. Navy warship in history. She received 20 battle stars for her service in World War II, as well as the Presidential Unit Citation. And no other ship has come even close to that record. So this is a really impressive ship. And most importantly, she was really there when we needed her. So the development of the aircraft carrier actually started in World War I. The British were the first to operationally send aircraft off of ships. The first landing on a ship was actually Eugene Ely, who landed on the USS Pittsburgh, an armored cruiser. But the British were really the first to develop it into an operational concept. And then after World War I is when purpose-built aircraft carriers started to appear. And the first of those was actually the Japanese aircraft carrier Hosho. And things kind of continued from there. A major boost to aircraft carriers came from the Washington Treaty. I mentioned that before. The Washington Treaty was a disarmament treaty signed in 1922 by most of the major nations of the world. The reason being that a new arms race was beginning after World War I, primarily between the British, the United States, and Japan, to build larger battleship fleets. And everybody remembered that the battleship race between the British and the Germans had been a major contributing factor to World War I. And they also didn't feel that they had the budgets for this type of arms race. So these countries all got together and agreed to stop building new battleships, scrap some of the ones that were currently being built, and have what they called a battleship building holiday for a period of a few years. But one of the stipulations of the treaty was that each country could convert two existing or building warships into aircraft carriers. And so the British converted two of their small, well, they weren't really small. They were very lightly armed, but actually large ships. Battle cruisers, the Courageous and the Glorious, were converted into aircraft carriers, along with their third sister, the Furious. And then the Japanese converted the battleship Kaga and the battle cruiser Akagi into aircraft carriers. And the United States converted two battle cruisers that we were building into the aircraft carriers Lexington and Saratoga. Our first aircraft carrier was actually the USS Langley, which had been converted from a coaling ship, the Jupiter. But the Lexington and the Saratoga were really the first full-size carriers that we built. And these were huge ships. They had a lot of innovative features, and they were really useful to the United States during the 1920s and 30s as we developed aircraft carrier techniques and operational concepts. So after that, our first purpose-built aircraft carrier was the USS Ranger CV-4. But it turned out that after building the Ranger, she was a little bit too small. Part of the subsequent treaty stipulations, I believe this was the London Treaty, which was the follow-on to the Washington Treaty, was that we were allowed a certain set amount of tonnage of aircraft carriers that we could have. And within that, there were restrictions on how large aircraft carriers could be. So we were trying to figure out how to best fill out our remaining allotment of tonnage. And so our next two ships that we laid down were essentially in a large version of the Ranger, which would be big enough to have a more useful air group. These two ships became the Yorktown and the Enterprise, two of the most famous ships in the U.S. fleet. And they carried about 90 airplanes, so they were a little bit smaller than the Lexington and the Saratoga, but they had a roughly competitive air group. And then the third ship under that construction program was the USS Wasp, CV-7. That was built as kind of a slightly smaller version of the Yorktown class. And the reason why we went smaller with that was because we just didn't have enough tonnage left over to build a fully fledged third Yorktown class aircraft carrier. But things started to change. It was the late 1930s. I believe that Yorktown and Enterprise were completed around 1937 and 1938. And the storm clouds were brewing on the horizon. And so one by one, countries started to kind of drop out of the treaty. So Japan pulled out of the London Treaty, as I mentioned, the follow-on to the Washington Treaty, and secretly started building a battleship called the Yamato. We realized that we needed to start to rearm ourselves in preparation for the war that everybody knew was coming. And so the United States Navy created a standardized carrier design, which became known as the Essex class. But the Essex class wasn't going to be ready for a while, and we realized we were going to need new ships right away. And so it was decided that it would be most expedient to build a third Yorktown class aircraft carrier, and that ship became USS Hornet CV-8. So at the beginning of World War II, we actually had seven aircraft carriers in commission. The Langley had been converted into a seaplane tender by this point. And the United States got drawn into World War II, as everybody knows, by the Pearl Harbor attack. And that was carried out by six Japanese Navy aircraft carriers, the Akagi, the Kaga, the Hiryu, the Soryu, the Shokaku, and the Zuikaku. And they based their attack plan on the Pearl Harbor on a attack that the British had actually dealt to the Italians in the 1940 by their aircraft carrier, the Illustrious, which had neutralized half of the Italian surface battle fleet. So the Japanese saw a similar opportunity in Pearl Harbor. As we all know, Pearl Harbor was a devastating attack for the U.S. Pacific Fleet, and it was really the first time that battleships had been taken out on such a large scale by aircraft carriers. And only one day later, two famous British ships, the battleship Prince of Wales and the battlecruiser Repulse, were sunk in open water by Japanese aircraft. So this was really the first indication that aircraft were gaining ascendancy over the battleship. But the Japanese made a crucial mistake. They attacked on the wrong day because none of our aircraft carriers were at Pearl Harbor when the attack happened. And so our entire aircraft carrier fleet was intact and ready to take the fight back to the Japanese. They started out the war by conducting some raids on Pacific Islands. These didn't do a whole lot of damage, but they were primarily psychological. They helped kind of increase US morale and let the Japanese know that we weren't completely done yet at this point. However, a really famous raid occurred during this period. The USS Enterprise escorted the USS Hornet. The Hornet carried a shipload of B-25 Mitchell bombers, and they launched what was called the Doolittle Raid against Tokyo. And kind of like the other Pacific Island raids, this didn't really do a whole lot of damage, but it was an extreme blow to Japanese morale because for the first time they realized that the home islands themselves were still vulnerable to air attack, and they were a huge boost to US morale. However, the Japanese still continued to inexorably advance across the Pacific, and their next major target was going to be Australia. And so the Japanese sent a fleet, including the large fleet carrier Shokaku and Zuikaku and the light carrier Shoho, to the Coral Sea. And in response, the United States sent the Lexington and the Yorktown. This Battle of the Coral Sea is hugely important to Navy history because it was the first naval battle in history where the two opposing fleets never even saw each other. It was carried out entirely by carrier-based aircraft. It was kind of a draw. The Shoho was sunk, as was the Lexington. But strategically, it was a victory for the US because the Japanese attempt to attack Australia was turned back. And this was really the first time that a Japanese advance had been halted. The Yorktown raced back to Pearl Harbor to get repaired. When she got there, they estimated that she would need a few weeks of repairs from the damage that she had received at the Coral Sea. But the US Navy codebreakers had determined that another threat was looming. Four Japanese aircraft carriers, four of the ones that had attacked Pearl Harbor, were on their way to the US-held island of Midway, which is at the extreme western end of the Hawaiian island chain. We determined that we needed to stop this and we needed the Yorktown there. And so they only had 24 hours to turn the Yorktown around and get her ready for service. So the Yorktown, the Enterprise, and the Hornet all headed out to Midway to try to stop the Japanese fleet. And what ensued was considered the turning point of the Pacific War, probably the most famous naval battle in US Navy history, and a very important moment for the United States. We caught the Japanese by surprise. They did not realize that the US fleet was going to be coming. This battle could warrant an entire episode by itself, but suffice it to say that all four Japanese aircraft carriers present at that battle were sunk. So that was a huge triumph for the US. Unfortunately, we did lose the Yorktown. She was struck by Japanese aircraft, and I will always have admiration for the Yorktown. She was a tough ship because even after being hit by torpedoes and bombs by Japanese planes, she refused to sink. The ship was abandoned. So they did call abandoned ship, but it refused to go down. And so then they thought, okay, well, maybe we might be able to save the ship. So they got back on board. And then I think a day or two later, she was hit by additional torpedoes from a Japanese submarine, which was a real bummer. And we did end up losing the Yorktown. So by this point, we had already lost the Lexington and the Yorktown. So we were starting to lose our ships. The next major campaign was the Guadalcanal campaign. And this was the first time that the US fleet really went on the offensive, trying to take back some originally Australian-held islands that the Japanese had captured. This was a vicious series of naval campaigns stretching over a period of several months. So many ships were sunk during this series of battles that the area around the island of Guadalcanal became known as Iron Bottom Sound. And almost all of our remaining major fleet carriers were involved in this in some capacity. The Ranger was actually the only US carrier that was never deployed to the Pacific at this point. She was considered too small to actually be helpful. So anyway, the fight began. One of the early battles was the Battle of the Eastern Solomons. That resulted in some damage to the Enterprise. But kind of the major set piece carrier battle of the Guadalcanal campaign was the Battle of Santa Cruz. And the Enterprise and the Yorktown opposed a large Japanese carrier force. And interestingly, they were screened by a battleship, the USS South Dakota. And this was kind of an early example of the battleship's new role as an escort for the aircraft carriers. The South Dakota reportedly shot down 26 planes during this action, but the Hornet ended up being sunk. And so the Hornet was gone. Some of our other ships also had to go home or were sunk. So the Wasp was sunk by a submarine, and the Saratoga, I believe, was hit by a torpedo and had to return to the West Coast. So all of a sudden, lo and behold, it's the end of 1942. The Guadalcanal campaign is actually coming to a close, but the Enterprise is the only United States aircraft carrier active in the Pacific. And so this was a pretty desperate situation. However, undaunted, her crew put up a banner in the hangar deck that simply said Enterprise versus Japan. And that showed their determination and how serious the situation was at this point. But things started to turn around. On the last day of 1942, the USS Essex, the first of the new breed of aircraft carriers, was commissioned. And the United States would go on to build 24 Essex-class aircraft carriers, all of them bigger than the Enterprise. And throughout 1943, they started to join the fleet, and the force just got larger and larger. The United States Pacific Fleet at this time was organized into what were called task forces, the most famous of which were Task Force 38 and Task Force 58. I think they were actually the same group of ships and got renamed when they got a new admiral involved. And this fleet is what really conducted what's known as the island hopping campaign across the Pacific. And this was the rollback of the Japanese outposts leading back to the home islands. All throughout 1943, or most of 1943, the Japanese really kind of avoided confronting the U.S. Pacific Fleet after the disastrous Guadalcanal campaign. They were really trying to rebuild their forces after Midway. They were commissioning some new aircraft carriers, but they had a serious shortage of trained pilots because Midway had really wiped out a lot of their carrier air groups. Eventually, there was a fight near the Philippines. The Japanese finally sent out their remaining carrier forces at the Battle of the Philippine Sea. This became known as the Great Marianas Turkey Shoot because the inexperienced Japanese pilots were shot down in droves, both by U.S. fighter aircraft and by ship-based anti-aircraft weapons. And the Japanese lost over 365 airplanes on one day, which was a devastating blow from which the Japanese fleet air arm never recovered. There was one final major battle involving the aircraft carriers that was still to come, and that was the Battle of Leyte Gulf, which again could warrant its own entire episode. But that was the U.S. attempt to take back the Philippines, and this was, depending on how you measure this, the largest naval battle in history. The United States sent over 800 ships of varying sizes, and the Japanese sent 65 combat ships, which at this point represented the almost entirety of their remaining navy. But the Japanese aircraft carriers, because of the Battle of the Philippine Sea, didn't have very many airplanes. And so they were actually sent empty as a decoy force and were hunted down and destroyed by the U.S. aircraft carriers. We'll talk about this in another episode at some point, I'm sure. But this maneuver actually left the U.S. invasion fleet open to an attack by Japanese battleships, which was turned back almost miraculously. But after this battle, the Japanese aircraft carriers ceased to be a major threat. So the U.S. Pacific Fleet's aircraft carriers continued to press home the attack against Japan. They were present at Okinawa, where a lot of them were damaged by kamikaze aircraft. But the Enterprise was there for almost every major battle. Even though she was an older ship and the Essex class had kind of taken over, she was there for almost all of them. So eventually, the war came to a close, as we know. And the Enterprise, a veteran ship which had served her country well, did one final service for us. She participated in what was called Operation Magic Carpet, and that was bringing servicemen back home from their deployments overseas. And she brought several thousand troops back to the United States. After that, the Enterprise was decommissioned. We kind of, at this point, had too many aircraft carriers. The United States in 1945, if you count escort carriers, which are smaller ships, actually had 99 aircraft carriers in commission. And there was no reason for us to have that many once the war was over. And so older tonnage was gradually retired. There were only three pre-war U.S. aircraft carriers that remained out of the original eight. And that was the Ranger, which had stayed in the Atlantic the whole time. the Enterprise and the Saratoga. The Saratoga was actually tragically blown up as part of the Bikini Atoll nuclear test, which a lot of us ship buffs are still mad about. But the Enterprise stuck around for a little while in the reserve fleet. There was an attempt to try to save the Enterprise, the most famous and most decorated ship in the U.S. Navy's history, as a museum ship. And tragically, these efforts failed. And the Enterprise was scrapped in 1956 in what many consider to be one of the greatest crimes against Navy history that has ever happened. But the name did live on. Pieces of the Enterprise, including one of her portholes, were incorporated in a new aircraft carrier that was being built around that time. And that was the USS Enterprise CVN-65, which was the first nuclear-powered aircraft carrier in the world. And actually, today, remains the longest aircraft carrier ever built. She was actually slightly longer than the Nimitz-class ships, which succeeded her. And that ship enjoyed a 50-year career before being retired in 2012. And unfortunately, she is also currently being scrapped because the Navy decided that it would be very complicated to try to remove her nuclear reactors and turn her into a museum ship. But the legacy isn't over. The United States is currently building a series of ships called the Gerald R. Ford class aircraft carriers, and these are our next generation nuclear powered aircraft carriers. They're having some teething issues at the moment, but I'm confident that those will be resolved. The third ship of that class, CVN-80, will be the third aircraft carrier, USS Enterprise. And I really hope that that porthole from CV-6 goes into her as well. But the Enterprise left behind a proud legacy. After World War II, the battleship pretty much disappeared from the scene as a major surface combatant until a brief resurgence in the 80s, which we'll probably cover in a future episode. And today, the United States still maintains, I think, 11 large fleet carriers in service, as well as smaller amphibious assault ships. And the aircraft carrier has continued to be, since World War II, the major striking capital ship of the fleet. So that's what we have for Enterprise CV-6. And thanks for listening to our episode today.
Yes, I can hear that water coming into the dry dock. We are out of time for today. I hope you all learned something. I hope you all appreciate that losing Enterprise and losing Vanguard and losing all these ships was a crime against history. I think we could both agree on that.
We can. Although I will point out that if you want to see a real authentic World War II aircraft carrier, we are lucky because there are several in existence. The Intrepid, the Yorktown, the Hornet, and one other one, I'm trying to remember which one it is, are all still in existence, and you can visit them today as museums. And then the Midway, which was a slightly later ship, is also available to visit as a museum. So there's still some opportunities to see them, and I hope you all have the opportunity to do that at some
point. Absolutely. All right. Well, it's been a fine job sailing with you today, and we wish you all fair winds and calm seas. Goodbye, everybody.
Thanks. And I just remembered it was the Lexington. That's the other one that's still around. So you can visit him. Thanks for listening, guys.
Goodbye.